So this will be another Thursday test, which means be an absolute cutoff at 11:45. So if you think that'll be a problem at all, show up early. Show up at 10:15. By the way, I finally got around to complaining about the benchmark machine, which is the thing that grades your, the fact that it wasn't showing you the incorrect answers in that first column. Well, someone went to fix it, and now it's entirely broken. So I hope I don't have to hand grade these, but I will if I need to, because I need to get your scores quickly so that you can make that final determination of whether you're going to stay in the course before the November 2nd deadline. November 2nd, isn't it? Withdrawal deadline. Okay, let's go to slide 7 now. It seems like there's a lot more left in this chapter in terms of slides, but the slides that are left shouldn't take too much time. We should hopefully even get out early. In slide 7, we're looking at a nerve, a single nerve, and what you see is that there are wrappings, membranes that wrap around the components of a nerve that are completely analogous to the wrappings we've already talked about in whole muscles. Right? Remember, there's epimysium around a whole muscle, and then paramysium around fascicles, and then endomysium around individual myofibers. You have the same setup in a whole nerve. So, by the way, I don't have to say whole nerve. When I say just the word nerve, that really means the whole nerve. Nerve never really means a cell. If I want to talk about a single cell, I'll either say nerve cell, nerve fiber, or neuron. So the nerve is hierarchically arranged just like a whole muscle is. In other words, the nerve itself is a bundle of smaller things called fascicles, just like, exactly the same word as in whole muscles. You can see several different fascicles in the cross-section of the whole nerve. Each fascicle is itself a bundle of smaller things, which are the neurons themselves. And for most of that length, it's just the axon part of the neuron. And that's what's labeled as nerve fibers. Notice that in any given fascicle, there can be both myelinated and unmyelinated nerve fibers, and also in terms of flow of information, there can be both sensory and motor information flowing through that same fascicle, of course through different neurons, because any given neuron is always either afferent or efferent. It doesn't change the direction of its own transmission of signals. But just like the muscle, there are wrappings around these components. So a membrane that covers a single neuron, single axon or nerve fiber, is called endoneurium instead of endomysium. So you just change the M-Y-S part, which meant muscle before, to N-E-U-R, which refers to the neuron or the nervous system, right? So endoneurium wraps individual nerve fibers. Paraneurium wraps individual fascicles. And epineurium wraps the entire nerve. Let's go to slide 8 and classify in various ways nerve fibers. Notice the different shadings in the groups of rows here. We've already defined afferent and efferent, right? So nerve fibers refer to individual cells. An individual cell is classified as either afferent or efferent. What are the corresponding words? Afferent corresponds to what? Sensory. Efferent corresponds to motor. And so that classification is based solely on the direction of travel of the nerve impulse, the nerve signals. Whether they're going toward the central nervous system, which is what afferent is, or away from the central nervous system, which is what efferent is. Somatic fibers and visceral fibers It's not that they're different from afferent and efferent fibers. It's just classifying them a different way. All right. So somatic and visceral, that distinction is based on what things get innervated by these fibers rather than the direction of flow of the information. All right. So somatic, as you see, innervates pretty much everything except the internal organs, which are the viscera. So skin, skeletal muscles, bones, and joints, those are the somatic fibers that connect to those. Whereas the visceral fibers are named for the fact that they connect or innervate the viscera, which are the deep organs, things like intestines, liver, kidney, and so on. And so that's just a different way of classifying fibers. Well, in this third pair of rows on the bottom, we can classify them as general and special. That's yet another way of classifying them. General fibers innervate widespread organs, the muscles, skin, glands, viscera, blood vessels. Widespread here meaning as opposed to specialized parts that are mainly in the head, and that we'll talk more about when we get to the chapter on special senses. So the special sense organs are the really complex and specialized and localized organs that you find in the head. Eyes, ears, tongue, nose. Those are innervated by special fibers. Those are special senses. They're not the only senses you have. You also have what are called general senses spread out through your body. And those are innervated by general fibers. Okay, now to 9. We've covered most of this material when you look at the top picture. We've already talked about rootlets and the fact that rootlets combine to form roots, and then two roots, a posterior or dorsal and an anterior or ventral root, combine to form the actual spinal nerve. That's officially the beginning of the spinal nerve, where the two roots come together. So that's old information at this point. Here we just get a good look at the inset. So the bottom view is just a close-up view of what's shown in the black box above. And it just shows you detail of a ganglion and really proves to you that it is a ganglion. We talked about the dorsal root ganglia. There's one on either side, of course, because spinal nerves are paired. There aren't ventral root ganglia, there are only dorsal root ganglia, because only the dorsal root has cell bodies, and that's the definition of a ganglion, right? A group of cell bodies occurring in the peripheral nervous system. So we're outside of the spinal cord, that's why it's a peripheral nervous system. And the reason that it's an enlargement is because cell bodies take up more volume than the diameter of an axon does. So when you get a bunch of cell bodies clustered together, that's why it's a bump on the overall root. So these dorsal root ganglia, by the way, the dorsal root is carrying what kind of information exclusively? Now the nerve is two-way traffic. It's carrying information in both directions, but each root is one-way traffic. What did I say is the information that's being carried by dorsal roots? That's where it connects to the back of the spinal cord. Dorsal roots carry only sensory information. Remember I said that even if you're being touched in the front of your body, that information is going to enter the spinal cord through dorsal roots, as all sensory information that connects to the spinal cord does. Whereas all motor information exiting from the spinal cord is coming out from the front, no matter where the effector organ, the muscle that's going to be moved, or the gland that's going to be stimulated, is located in the body. All right, so that's why roots are one-way collections of fibers, whereas nerves are two-way collections. Well, so this ganglion, since it's a dorsal root ganglion, with the only kind of ganglion you have in these roots, Those are sensory neurons. Every one of those cell bodies is a cell body of a sensory neuron. And therefore, information is coming into the spinal cord. That information, the first action potential in the series of action potentials that make up a nerve signal, that happened far away, potentially far away, somewhere in the body, right? At the nerve ending. So it could be the fingertips or whatever. The very tip of it would be considered the dendrite. But then that dendrite becomes immediately the axon. And then that axon is however long it needs to be to get almost all the way to the spinal cord. Actually, the axon does make it all the way to the spinal cord. But almost when you get to the ganglion, which is almost to the spinal cord, there's a little offshoot from the axon, and that's where the cell body is connected to. So what kind of what kind of neurons are these sensory neurons classified as, based on a couple of lectures ago when we were talking about the shape, different shapes of neurons? Well, what are the possibilities? What are the categories of different neurons? Bipolar is one classification, right? The different names with different number of poles in them, really, is what the distinction is. And remember, the poles are the connection points with the cell body. Well, here there's only one connection point. It's that little offshoot from the axon that connects to the cell body. So sensory neurons are classified as what? Unipolar neurons. And all of those little offshoots occur in one place, basically, because all these cell bodies are clustered together to make up this dorsal root ganglion. You don't have a ganglion in the ventral root because where are those cell bodies? Based on the last lecture's knowledge. The lower motor neurons cell bodies are located in the spinal cord itself. And then the axon comes out from there to form the nerve, to form the root and eventually and then the nerve. Okay, let's go to 10. We had a very similar picture to this early on, I think probably slide 2 in this chapter, whatever it was. The difference here is that you see different names for spinal nerves. So there are, remember, the spinal nerves are just one major kind of category of nerves. Cranial nerves we'll address in a different chapter. The cranial nerves connect to the brain. That's one part of the central nervous system. The spinal nerves connect to the other part of the central nervous system, which is the spinal cord. And there are 31 pairs of spinal nerves. Now, there's a greater number of nerves overall, of course, because spinal nerves then branch into several different nerves that have individual names and go to specific parts of the body. But there are 31 pairs of spinal nerves, and you can see that they are named for the parts of the spinal column. So there are cervical nerves, there are thoracic nerves, there are lumbar nerves, there are sacral nerves, and there are coccygeal nerves corresponding to those bones of the vertebral column. And notice, though, that there are 8 pairs of cervical nerves. Why does that not seem to make sense? Right, because there are 7 cervical vertebrae, not 8. So the rest of the numbers match up. But the reason that there are 8 cervical nerve pairs rather than 7 is because the first one, C1 pair, emerges between the atlas and the skull itself. And then there's one between atlas and axis, in other words, just below C1, just below C2, and all the way through just below C7. So that's 8 total. In other words, if you have all of the bones laid out, and you consider all the spaces between them, plus a space between that first bone and the skull, there's an extra space. That's why there's an extra cervical nerve. In addition to these pairs of nerves being categorized this way, based on the vertebrae, remember that the place where they emerge from through vertebral intervertebral foramina between the actual vertebrae is not necessarily the place where they actually come off of the spinal cord, because the spinal cord has segments, and that's really the major difference between this slide and the one that looks close to it originally. The spinal cord is broken into segments that have basically the same alphanumeric designation as the bones, but they're not lined up because the spinal cord is shorter than the spinal column. And so that's why you have, in some cases, these roots going downward before the spinal nerve that they converge into emerges through intervertebral foramina. Now, what is the what's the combination of all the vertebral foramina, which are not intervertebral? Remember, there's a difference. Intervertebral foramina are the holes formed. Each intervertebral foramen is formed by two different vertebrae forming half of the hole each. And that's and the hole that forms is a horizontal passageway. It's a transverse passageway. That's where the spinal nerves come out from the spinal column. The vertebral foramen for each vertebra, the vertebral foramen is the hole that is, the passage through that hole would be vertical, right? And so all of those lined up, all of those vertebral foramina combined make up what space? What's the name of that overall space? Oh, maybe I didn't even mention it. All of those vertebral foramina combine to form what's called the vertebral canal. And so that vertebral canal is the space that the spinal cord is in. But what I'm trying to say in a different way is that the spinal cord does not occupy the entire vertebral canal. I mean, the entire vertebral canal is longer than the spinal cord, because the spinal cord ends at the tip of the conus medullaris, and then nerve fibers that come off of that tip of the spinal cord but actually are not part of the spinal cord and descend through the rest of the vertebral canal, those are what make up the cauda equina until they eventually come out through intervertebral foramina to become spinal nerves. All right? So that's what you're seeing in this region. The brown, where the brown ends up there, that's the end of the spinal cord. And then finally, what we haven't talked about that's shown in this slide are that spinal nerves, soon after coming through these intervertebral foramina, form what are called plexuses, except in the thoracic region. So for all the other regions, there is a plexus, or a pair of plexuses, named for that region. There aren't thoracic plexuses, though. Notice that there is a cervical plexus, there's a brachial plexus, there's a lumbar plexus, there's a sacral plexus, and there's a coccygeal plexus. Well, what about this word plexus? It's a word that means an interweaving. So a plexus is a structure that has a web-like appearance. It's a good descriptor for a nerve plexus because you have a bunch of convergence and divergence at each plexus. So it makes it look like a web-like arrangement. Okay? But you don't see that in the thoracic region, only in the others. Now to slide 11. Well, this is a transverse section that we're looking at, of course. We're looking at the cell body. So remember, the cell bodies are in the front. That's why the bottom of the picture is labeled as anterior. And we've already looked at most of this information, but we haven't talked about really what's happening right outside of the intervertebral foramen. So where you see the dorsal root ganglion and the ventral root coming together, notice that that coming together is happening right about where that intervertebral foramen is. The vertebra just above it, which would be in front of this in this picture, would form the other half of that intervertebral foramen where the spinal nerve is coming out in either side. So that's the official beginning of that spinal nerve. Very soon after emerging from the intervertebral foramen, though, is where we're getting into the new information. You have branches that occur of that spinal nerve. And another name for a branch is a ramus, R-A-M-U-S, plural rami. This is the same root as in ramify or ramifications. If you want to talk about something's ramifications, that really refers to all the possibilities that could occur as kind of as a branches based on what the original happening is, right? The consequences are the ramifications because of branching. That's ramus means branch. So there are posterior rami and anterior rami, one of each on either side. So the left spinal nerve at whatever level we're at branches into an anterior and a posterior ramus, but also a meningeal branch, which is much smaller. Now the posterior ramus is pretty much smaller than the anterior ramus, as you can see in terms of diameter. But the meningeal branch is much smaller still. And you don't really get a good look at the meningeal branch here. It kind of just cuts off in this picture. But that little slender branch, the meningeal branch, is so named because it then re-enters the intervertebral foramen and innervates the meninges themselves and the intervertebral joints. Okay, the two major rami, the posterior and anterior rami, then branch further into eventually named nerves, depending on what part of the body they go to. But before they actually branch into named nerves, they can become part of plexuses, except, as I said, in the thoracic region. Now, on the right side, we can see still other names of rami, these so-called communicating rami. And so, branching from the anterior ramus itself are two more rami called the communicating rami. And we'll talk more about those in a different chapter. But notice that they both connect to what is called a sympathetic ganglion. So-called because it's an important part of the sympathetic nervous system. And each sympathetic ganglion, or each pair of, well, there's one on either side at each level for a while. Not the entire length of the spinal column, but there are several different pairs of sympathetic ganglia, and they are all connected to each other by vertical connections. And so they form what are called the sympathetic chain ganglia, because they're arranged like links in a chain. And we'll be talking about their function in a different chapter as well. But slide 12 shows you a pictorial representation of them. So now we're looking, notice this is listed as an anterolateral view, which means kind of diagonal view, somewhere between anterior and lateral. So we're looking at it from the front side. You can see a good view of part of the sympathetic chain of ganglia on one side. There's a corresponding chain on the other side that's hidden. And you can see that those communicating rami connect to a sympathetic ganglion that is nearby the ramus that the communicating rami branch off of. All right? All these big rami that branch, all these big rami that the communicating rami come off of are the anterior rami. The posterior rami are the smaller ones that go toward the back of the body. And part B of this is just showing you a cross-sectional view through the thoracic region, which is why you don't have these things become plexuses. You just have them become nerves. In this case, intercostal nerves. Intercostal meaning between the ribs. And so they innervate, among other things, they innervate intercostal muscles, which are the muscles that connect a rib below to a rib above it. And they're important for you to move the rib cage in breathing. Now to 13, in which we see a better view of a plexus. Now each plexus is different. You know, plexuses are paired. So you have cervical plexus on either side, you have brachial plexus on either side, and so on. But the brachial plexus, which is what we're looking at here, is different in how it's connected together compared to the cervical plexus and the other plexuses. This one's just showing you, and I'm not going to show you a picture of all of them because that's not the point. I chose the brachial plexus to show you because in terms of the plexus itself, the organization of it, it's probably more complex in terms of interconnections than the other ones are. So I wanted to make sense of this color coding, the purple, orange, and so on, that make up the plexus itself. The purple parts, which are the parts that are of the plexus that are closest to the spinal cord, these really, notice first of all that they're called roots. So the roots are really just extensions of the anterior rami of the spinal nerves coming out from those positions. Okay? So keep in mind, you have a posterior and an anterior root, a dorsal and a ventral root combined to form the spinal nerve. That's the very beginning. Then that spinal nerve then branches. After coming together, it branches. You have an anterior ramus and a posterior ramus. The anterior ramus, part of that becomes what we're seeing in purple here. Okay? But they're called roots again. This is a different word, root. I mean, it's the same word, but it's a different structure compared to the root that was contributing to the spinal nerve, right? The roots, the ventral and dorsal roots, are really not officially part of the spinal nerve. But when they converge, they become the spinal nerve. That's inside the vertebral canal before the spinal nerve comes out of the intervertebral foramen. All right? This use of the word root is totally different. This use of the word root is really part of the anterior ramus of that spinal nerve and others in the area, and it's part of the plexus. So don't be confused by the same use of the word. Moving away from the spinal cord, you next get to the red region, which are trunks. And then trunks give rise to divisions. And so there's a division anteriorly and posteriorly in different colors here. So divisions are farther away from the spinal cord than trunks, which themselves are farther away than roots. And then divisions finally give rise to cords, the brown parts. And then after that, you're really out of the plexus itself. So notice everything that's colored purple, red, green, blue, and brown together makes up the plexus, and that's the web-like arrangement that gives it the name plexus. Once you get to the yellow part, which is the farthest part away from the spinal curve, that's shown at least, then you start getting into branches from the plexus that get individual names for individual nerves, like median nerve, ulnar nerve, and so on, that are usually pretty explanatory in terms of where they go, what they innervate. Now, I shouldn't say, I cautiously say where they go, because the ulnar nerve, for instance, of course, is named for the fact that it innervates near the ulna, but where they go kind of indicates a one-way direction of flow of information, and that's not true. The ulnar nerve goes to the ulna, but it contains many neurons, some of which are sensory, bringing information from the ulna, some of which are motor, taking information toward the ulna. Okay? And that's why the word branch, when we're talking about nerves, is also kind of misleading, because sometimes what is shaped like a branch is better called, those branches are better to be called tributaries if the flow of information is toward the convergence point rather than, you know, a divergence forms branches in terms of flow. A convergence is formed by tributaries coming together. But when we're talking about two-way traffic, which is usually the case, then branch and tributary are both halfway wrong, and there's really no good way of talking about it other than that. All right. Now let's talk about reflexes. This is slide 14. A reflex is, first of all, an anatomical word, whereas a reflex is a physiological term, whereas reflex arc is anatomical. Okay? A reflex is an occurrence. It's an event. Whereas a reflex arc is the structures that actually allow for the reflex to happen. And a reflex arc also is the smallest set of structures that you can have that actually perform all of the major functions of the nervous system in general. This is kind of analogous to saying that the sarcomere is the functional unit of muscle because it's the smallest bit that you can have that will still do what muscle does, which is to shorten, like a myosin filament by itself is not enough. You have to have a sarcomere at least. Well, if you have a reflex arc, that really does all the major functions of the nervous system, which means it is going to carry sensory information, it's going to perform some integration, and it's going to send out motor or efferent information and cause a response. All right? But reflexes are not high-level processing. Reflexes evolved as a way to protect you in some cases, and just as a way to make it easier to maintain your posture, for instance, to get things done for homeostasis, at least at the immediate level. Because high-level processing, which involves the brain, and which involves, therefore, many, many synapses, which is why it can be high-level. Remember, the more synapses you have, the more opportunity for integration you have. That's what can make things so complex. But every synapse that you add adds time to the processing. Because moving a nerve signal along a single axon doesn't take very long, especially if it's myelinated. Things get slowed down at the chemical synapses because you have the exocytotic release of neurotransmitter and then all the stuff that happens in the postsynaptic cell. So that every synapse you add adds time to the processing. Well, it's important to have that high-level processing, but it's sometimes important to just start processing it before the brain even hears about it or learns about it. All right, that's what reflexes do, in a sense. And so many reflexes, in fact, most reflexes, involve only the spinal cord in terms of the central nervous system. There are some reflexes that involve the brain. Those specifically involve the brain stem. And we'll talk a little bit more about those in a different chapter as well, because this is about the spinal cord and spinal reflexes. So I mentioned this before, a reflex, it's not that a reflex doesn't allow the brain to be involved. It's just that the brain doesn't have to be involved. Information flows to the spinal cord and then back to an effector organ with a minimum of synapses so that it is a maximum speed at which it operates. But when that information reaches the spinal cord, neurons can take that information up the spinal cord to the brain for higher level processing, including awareness that it's happening. So reflexes happen, they have a few important characteristics. They are stereotyped, which means they always happen the same way. If you continue to invoke a reflex over and over, it's still going to happen the same way, basically. Whereas, for instance, if you continue to be touched over and over, you're going to change the way that feels to you because your body adjusts to that continuous stimulation. Reflexes are stereotyped. They're always the same. They're also subconscious. Now, that doesn't mean you cannot be aware of them, but the awareness is actually not part of the reflex itself. The reflex can tell the brain about it, and that other high-level processing is its own thing. The reflex itself is just what's happening with the neurons that connect to and from the spinal cord. In slide 14, we're looking at the anatomy of a reflex arc. Remember, I said that the reflex arc is actually the anatomy that allows for a reflex to happen. And in any given reflex arc, there have to be a certain few minimum components. There has to be some sort of sensory receptor. Now, that sensory receptor could be a specialized type of cell or group of cells. In this simplest case, though, that sensory receptor is simply a free nerve ending. And by nerve ending, I'm talking about the ganglion end of a sensory neuron. Okay? So not an additional cell. The neuron itself can, in certain cases, act as a sensory receptor. But there has to be some sort of sensory receptor which receives the signal originally. Next, there has to be a sensory neuron, which is what's shown in red here. Now, it's labeled as an afferent nerve fiber, but you should know that is really just different language for saying sensory neuron, right? Afferent and sensory are interchangeable. Nerve fiber and neuron are interchangeable. So the red thing is the sensory neuron. That has to be there. That takes it to the spinal cord, if we're talking about a spinal reflex, which we are in this chapter. Once you're in the spinal cord, there is always, at least one synapse. Because if you don't have a synapse, then you don't have any integration. And integration is part of the reflex, right? Integration occurs at synapses. So there's always at least one synapse. In the simplest case, which is shown here, there's only one synapse, a direct synapse between the sensory neuron in red and the motor neuron in green. All right? But there are some reflexes in which you have one or maybe even multiple interneurons housed entirely within the spinal cord. So the sensory neuron would innervate or synapse with an interneuron, and then that interneuron either synapses with another interneuron or synapses with the motor neuron. So these interneurons, however many there are in a sense optional in terms of the bare minimum requirements for a reflex arc. That's why it's not shown here. But there are several reflexes that do involve them. Like I said, though, reflexes really want to keep the interneurons to a minimum, because even though the more interneurons there are, the more integration there can be and the more complexity there can therefore be, but also the more it slows it down because there's more synapses. So interneurons are not a required component, but they are a frequent component. The next required component is the motor neuron itself. By the way, notice that the cell body of the sensory neuron, just like other ones that are not part of reflex arcs, are housed in the peripheral nervous system because they are part of the dorsal root ganglion, like we've already been talking about. That's why that red circle is in the dorsal root ganglion. Whereas the green circle, which is the cell body of the motor neuron, is in the spinal cord, specifically in the gray matter of the spinal cord. And that's why it makes sense that it's the gray matter, right? Because cell bodies are not myelinated. Gray matter is unmyelinated tissue. Anyway, the motor neuron is a required component of the reflex arc, and it emerges from the spinal cord, and notice it does so through the ventral root, as in all cases of motor information. And then the motor neuron sends information to the final required component of the reflex arc, which is an effector organ. And an effector organ is, as I've already mentioned, either a muscle of some type or a gland. In this case, it's a skeletal muscle, but it could be a cardiac muscle or smooth muscle, because there are reflexes, for instance, that are responsible for adjusting the diameter of the vessels. That involves innervating smooth muscle, which is what vasoconstricts or vasodilates your vessels. Or a gland is an effector organ as well. All right, so those are the required components, and this one is showing you one that I'm sure you're familiar with, a reflex involving the tendon at your patella that causes your leg to kick. And you don't have to think about that leg kicking, right? It happens without your brain being involved. Your brain does find out about it, but that's because of that extra wiring that's not actually part of the reflex arc. And that's why it's also really kind of difficult to keep it from happening. You have to kind of know that it's going to happen, first of all, and intentionally keep your leg stiff for it not to happen, because what you're doing then is sending information down from your brain to keep this reflex arc from operating normally. If you're not aware it's going to happen, then it's going to happen. All right, now let's look at a couple specific examples of reflexes. This is slide 15. And what we're looking at here are what are called muscle spindles. Now, a muscle spindle, which you see in close-up view in this white thing that's been opened up, a muscle spindle is a collection of muscle fibers and therefore muscle cells, but they're specialized compared to normal muscle cells. The vast majority of the muscle cells in a muscle are there to do the job that we've already talked about. They're there to shorten and therefore to contribute to the overall force that the whole muscle is contracting with to pull on whatever tendon it's connected to, right? That's what the run-of-the-mill muscle cells do. But there are specialized clusters of muscle cells called muscle spindles, and they really don't contribute. They contribute negligibly to the actual force of contraction of the whole muscle, because really they're only able to contract at their very ends. And the only reason they do that is just to take up any slack that there might be in them. For instance, if the whole muscle gets shortened, these muscle spindles would be slack, and therefore you would have to stretch them some before they even notice that they are being stretched. These muscle spindles they operate in what we call the stretch reflex. So if they're so lax that you have to stretch them before they even feel being stretched, that would be bad, right? Therefore, the ends of the spindles contract a little bit just to take the slack out of the system, so that if they get stretched any more beyond that, they will sense it. All right? The middle part, so not the ends that are contractile, but the middle part of each spindle is non-contractile. which is unusual for a muscle cell, right? These do not have sarcomeres in them, so they don't shorten. The middle part of each muscle spindle is there to act as a sensory organ. And notice that attached to each muscle spindle are neurons, shown in yellow here. By the way, these muscle cells that make up the spindle are called intrafusal. The fusal part of that comes from fusiform, which means spindle-shaped, basically. They're spindle. The reason they're called a spindle shape means bulging in the middle and tapering at the ends. And that's another word for that is fusiform. So that's why these things are called intrafusal, because they're inside the spindle, whereas the normal contractile muscle cells are called extrafusal. Okay? Outside of the spindle. So these neurons in yellow that connect to the spindle fibers come in sensory and motor varieties. In terms of the flow of information, of course, the sensory neurons are invoked first, right? They're connected to the spindle, and when that spindle gets stretched, that's going to activate the sensory neurons that are connected to that spindle. That's the original signal. The fact that it's being stretched is the original stimulus. That causes a nerve signal in these sensory nerve fibers connected to the spindle. There are primary and secondary versions of that. The difference is that primary neurons continuously measure not only the length of the spindle, but also the change in length. So whether or not they're being stretched at the moment. Whereas the secondary only monitor just the length, not the change in length as well. But they're both sensory. Okay? And so these are carrying information, afferent information, toward the spinal cord. In terms of motor neurons, notice that there are ones that are listed gamma and ones that are listed as alpha. The gamma motor fibers are the ones that come back from the spinal cord to the actual spindle. And so they allow for fine-tuning of the actual spindle length based on these contractile ends that I talked about. But alpha fibers are the ones that we've been talking about for a couple chapters now. I just didn't call them alpha fibers at the time. The alpha fibers are the ones that innervate the extrafusal muscle fibers and therefore the contractile muscle fibers. So the neuromuscular junction that we spent so much time on, that's the neuromuscular junction between an alpha neuron, motor neuron, and the muscle cell. That's what really leads to the force of contraction in the whole muscle. We can see the operation of the stretch reflex in slide 16. And so this is the familiar one that at the doctor's office, right? You get hit with a little rubber hammer in the knee and you kick your leg out. Well, when you tap on the patellar ligament with the little hammer, what you're really doing, since you're kind of bending that ligament, is to pull on the muscle, the tendon. When you pull on that tendon, you pull on the muscle it's connected to. Not very much, but it doesn't have to be very much. Because, like I said, these muscle spindles have taken up their slack already so that they're at the appropriate length for the length of the muscle at the time. A small change in the length of that muscle is going to slightly stretch the spindles. And when they slightly stretch, that's going to cause the sensory neurons that connect to those spindles to fire, to create an action potential, which gets sent as a nerve signal to the spinal cord. So that's what's happening in 1 and 2. When you get to 3, what's happening here is you have a direct connection, so no interneuron. That's why this is a very fast reflex. The primary afferent neuron stimulates an alpha motor neuron in the spinal cord. And that's shown diagrammatically at the yellow nerve ending that is synapsing directly with the red neuron. motor neuron cell body. That efferent information, next to number three there on the diagram above, gets sent back to the muscle that's being stretched, right? Which is part of the quadriceps group that we talked about in lab. And what that causes to happen is just what you would expect for stimulation of a motor neuron innervating the quadriceps. It means the quadriceps is going to contract a little bit, right? So in other words, a reflex, the stretch reflex kind of undoes the original stretch. It responds to being stretched by contracting a little bit to undo that stretch. All right? Now, what's happening at the same time here, because look at the yellow sensory neuron. Notice that it branches in the spinal cord. And one of those branches is what directly innervates the motor neuron in red. The other branch, though, innervates a purple interneuron, which then innervates a blue motor neuron of a different type. The blue motor neuron goes to a different muscle. It goes to hamstrings muscles, right? The biceps femoris, the semitendinosus, and the semimembranosus make up the hamstrings muscles. Those are on the other side of the thigh, and they are therefore antagonists to the quadriceps. They are flexors of the knee, whereas the quadriceps muscles are extensors of the knee. Well, if you have both types of muscles that are antagonistic to each other simultaneously contract, you're just having them work against each other. So, this same reflex stimulates the muscle that's being stretched originally by the hammer and contracts it, but so that the two antagonists are not working against each other, the hamstrings muscles are inhibited so that they will not contract. All right? So that's the stretch reflex. Let's go to slide 17. Okay, here we're looking at what's called the withdrawal reflex. It's also sometimes called the flexor reflex. Withdrawal reflex, though, is a good descriptor because it causes you to withdraw from something that has just hurt you. This is an example of a reflex that protects you. And so in this example, this guy's stepping on a broken bottle that he didn't see under the water. I used the example of stepping on a tack in a previous lecture. What's happening here, of course, is that that's damaging the body, and therefore it makes sense to get away from that damaging thing, whatever it is, as soon as possible. As soon as possible means before your brain actually learns about this and before you create that sensation of pain, your body should take steps to get it away from that dangerous thing. And then you can, once you feel it, then you can have all kinds of complex behavior to respond after that. But unconsciously, subconsciously, you undergo this withdrawal reflex. So, of course, you have the stimulus that's being sent through a sensory neuron to the spinal cord. There are interneurons in this case because there's a need for more high-level processing. Greater integration requires greater number of synapses. So that's why you have the purple ones there, the interneurons. And so notice that one of these interneurons will stimulate the one that the plus sign is listed at, the left of the two red neurons, that one's being stimulated, and that is a motor neuron that goes to the hamstrings muscles in this example. The hamstrings are flexors of the knee. If this were happening at the fingertips, then it would be the biceps brachii, for instance. The flexors of the elbow are what would be invoked. Those would be stimulated. You want to flex the joint because flexing the joint, bending the joint, is going to get that part of the body away from the injurious material, whatever that is. All right, that's why it's called also the flexor reflex. So the hamstrings get stimulated to contract. That's what bends your knee and gets your foot away from the bottle. At the same time, though, the other purple neuron that corresponds to the minus sign up there with the other red motor neuron, that's going to inhibit the motor neuron that travels to the other side of the thigh that innervates the quadriceps muscles. So you don't want anything interfering with the ability to flex the knee. Therefore, you don't want the quadriceps to be contracted. They would just make it more difficult for the biceps or for the flexors to work. You want the extensors to actually relax in that limb so you can flex as quickly as possible. So that's why it's inhibitory information sent to the antagonist in that same limb. Now, all of that information is ipsilateral. It's occurring on the same side of the body, right? In the same limb. But that's not the only thing happening here. In addition to this, everything that's happening on the left side is in terms of wiring, which is this withdrawal reflex, you also have what's called cross extensor reflex occurring. Notice that a branch of one of the purple interneurons crosses over. What's the word for crossing over? Decussation. Yeah. So there's decussation that's occurring, and that's why this is called the crossed extension reflex, or crossed extensor reflex. They're both used in different books. Because it crosses from whatever side that the injury occurred to the other side of the body at the spinal cord. And then these blue motor neurons get involved as well. But these are motor neurons for the other limb. All right? Now, as soon as you flex one knee, and you've been standing on both limbs, as soon as you flex one knee reflexively, if that's all that happened, you would quickly fall over. And you might fall right onto that same bottle that just cut you, which would be bad, right? So when you go from two legs supporting you to one leg, you need to make sure that you stay upright. And part of that is to stiffen the other leg so that it can take that force, since you've removed the other leg from the scenario. That's what these blue neurons are all about. So on the other limb, because of the decussation that occurs at the spinal cord, in the other limb you have a motor neuron going to the extensors, which are the quadriceps muscles. Those get stimulated. So while the injured limb is flexing, simultaneously the other limb, which is the one you need to stand on, gets extended. The knee stiffens. And in order for that not to be interfered with simultaneously, the other blue neuron, which is going to the flexors of the uninjured limb, get relaxed. They get inhibited so that the hamstrings muscles in that other limb are relaxed. They won't work against stiffening the knee. And that alone would not balance you, but it's the first step. And that happens, like I said before, the brain really finds out about it. Very shortly thereafter, because of further wiring that goes up the spinal cord to the brain itself, that's when you actually create the sensation of pain, and a bunch of other integration is going to invoke the appropriate muscles to not only have your limb extended, or your knee extended on the one you're standing on, but bring in other muscles that will keep you from falling over, depending on proprioceptive information that's occurring in the body as well. Remember that proprioception is always sending sensory information to your brain about the positioning of all your limbs in any given moment. By the way, so that you have this crossed extensor reflex, that is really its own reflex, but it branches off in terms of reflex arcs. It branches off of this withdrawal reflex. And the withdrawal reflex itself, well, both of these actually, since they stimulate one muscle and then inhibit the antagonistic muscle simultaneously, that's called reciprocal innervation. What's reciprocal about it is that you have two antagonists, right? You only want to stimulate one of them. You want to inhibit the other ones because you don't want them fighting against each other. So you see, the fact that you send a motor neuron to both antagonists, but the information is different, that is called reciprocal innervation. I think 18 is the final slide. And what we're looking at here are tendon organs, which, not surprisingly, are found in tendons. Now, muscles are highly extensible, right? They're not actively extensible. They can't push. They can only pull. So they actively contract, but they also can be stretched. So they're extensible cells. Tendons aren't very extensible at all, though. They're like ropes. Ropes have a certain amount of stretch in them, but not very much, because that's what makes them effective at being bearers of tensile strength, tensile loads, right? But tendon is the connection point between a muscle and the bone that it connects to. So the bone is being pulled by the muscle, the force that's generated in the muscle, but indirectly, because the muscle directly pulls on the tendon, the tendon then directly pulls on the bone. Tendons are pretty well connected to bones, because there is a lot of nooks and crannies in that bony surface that allow for a lot of surface area contact between the tendon and the bone. So it's a really good connection. But of course, it has its load limits. And if you pull too hard on a tendon, you can actually remove it from the bone surface. You can tear it away, which is a bad injury, in, not only in terms of pain, but it takes a long time for that to heal, and it takes some human intervention in the form of surgery to allow it to heal. So these tendon organs evolved as a way to protect you from doing this on your own. Because if you too quickly and too completely contract a skeletal muscle, you can actually pull on that tendon with so much force that you can rip it away from the bone. The tendon organs are trying to prevent you from doing that reflexively. So the tendon organs are embedded in the tendon itself, and the tendon's made up of fibers. When there isn't much force being applied to the tendon, the fibers are a little bit loose. They're not compressed together like they would be if you pull on them. All the individual fibers are going to kind of compress together side to side as you pull on these fibers and make them more straight. So when that happens, that's how these tendon organs work as sensory devices. When they are pushed together side to side against each other because the fibers that they're members of get straightened, then that stimulates them to send information in the form of action potentials through the sensory neurons that connect to them, in yellow here. Okay? Now, if too much information is being sent, meaning too much force, a dangerous amount of force is being applied here at this muscle, then the reflex will automatically inhibit the muscle itself. The output would be inhibition of that same muscle that's associated with that tendon. So even though you might be intending to use more force, the reflex is trying to override your intention, and it will shut that muscle down. Also, it's remember that a whole muscle is a bunch of muscle fibers. And so it could be that just fibers in one part of the whole muscle are primarily pulling, and therefore just one part of the tendon is in danger. Well, you could achieve the overall same amount of overall whole muscle force if you spread it out among fibers throughout the entire width of the muscle rather than just using them all in one place. And so that's another thing that this reflex can serve to do. It can shut down the ones in this area, and therefore your brain will invoke other ones to give you the same force. So this will protect you from, in most cases, from tearing a tendon off of the bone by overexerting yourself. Of course, if the force is some outside force, like a football helmet hitting your knee or something, then it's going to tear anyway. But the reflex will be invoked. It just won't be successful in that case. I think that's it. Yes, it is. Remember to bring a form. I just hope the forms work on
Thursday.